Amadhava Kunyabihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunyabihari. Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhadi. Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhadi. Yasoda Nandana Braja Janarandana. Yasoda Nandana Braja Janarandana. Yamuna Tira Manachari. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Rasa Bihari ki jai, Samvira Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Nithai Gaur Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narada Uvacha. Sa Ekada Maheshvaso. Ratam Panchashvam Ashugam. Dvisham Dvichakram Ekaksham. Trivenam Panchabandhuram. Narada Uvacha. Sa Ekada Maheshvaso. Ratam Panchashvam Ashugam. Dvisham Dvichakram Ekaksham. Trivenam Panchabandhuram. Narada Uvacha. Sa Ekada Maheshvaso. Ratam Panchashvam Ashugam. Ekada Maheshvaso. Ratam Panchashvam Ashugam. Visham Tichakram Ekaksham. Trivenam Panchabandhuram. Matajis. Narada Uvacha. Ekada Maheshvaso. Ratam Panchashvam Ashugam. Visham Chichakram Ekangsham. Jivenam Panchabandhuram. Ratam Panchashvam Ashugam. Dvisham Trichakram Ekaksham. Trivenam Panchabandhuram. Narada Uvacha. Narada said, Saha King Puranjana. Ekada. Once upon a time. Maha-ishvasa. Carrying his strong bow and arrows. Ratam. Chariot. Pancha-ashvam. 5 horses. Ashugam. Going very swiftly. Dvi-isham, 2 arrows. Dvi-chakram, 2 wheels. Eka, 1. Aksham, axle. Tri, 3. Venum, flags. Pancha, 5. Bandhuram. Obstacles. So, this is text 1, and in Prabhupada's presentation, 1 through 3 are included together. So we've just chanted text 1. Here's the translation for texts 1 through 3. The great sage Narada continued, "My dear king, once upon a time, King Paranjana took up his great bow and equipped with golden armor and a quiver of unlimited arrows and accompanied by 11 commanders. He sat on his chariot driven by 5 swift horses and went to the forest named Pancha Prashta. He took with him in that chariot 2 explosive arrows. The chariot itself was situated on 2 wheels and 1 revolving axle. On the chariot were situated 3 flags, 1 rein, 1 chariot driver, 1 sitting place, 2 poles to which the harness was fixed, 5 weapons, and 7 coverings. The chariot moved in 5 different styles, and 5 obstacles lay before it. All the decorations of the chariot were made of gold." And the 3.5-page purport by Srila Prabhupada. I hope you're wide awake. Long purport. But it's very rich in explanation. These 3 verses explain how the material body of the living entity is under the control of the 3 qualities of the external energy. The body itself is the chariot. And the living entity is the owner of the body, as explained in Bhagavad Gita 2.13. Dehinosminyata dehe. The owner of the body is called the dehi, and he is situated within the body, specifically within the heart. The living entity is driven by 1 chariot driver. In this metaphor, it's different than the Bhagavad Gita metaphor. In this case, the driver is Super Soul, who supplies intelligence. The chariot itself is made of the 3 gunas, the 3 qualities of material nature, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 18.61. Yantra Rudhani Mayaya. The word yantra means, quote, carriage, unquote. The body is given by material nature, and the driver of that body is Paramatma, the Supersoul. The living entity is seated within the chariot. This is the actual position. That's the first paragraph. The living entity is always being influenced by the 3 qualities, sattva, rajas, and tamas. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7.13. Tribir gunamayir bhavai. The living entity is bewildered by the 3 qualities of material nature. These 3 qualities are described in this verse as 3 flags. By a flag, one can come to know who the owner of the chariot is. Similarly, by the influence of the 3 qualities of material nature, one can easily know the direction in which the chariot is moving. In other words, one who has eyes to see can understand how the body is being driven. Influenced by the particular quality of material nature. In these 3 verses, the activity of the living entity is described to prove how the body becomes influenced by the quality of ignorance, even when a person wants to be religious. Narada Muni wanted to prove to King Prachini Parishat that the king was being influenced by the tamoguna, the quality of ignorance, even though the king was supposed to be very religious. That's kind of like the whole allegory is to let him know you're in ignorance. And that's expanded in the next paragraph. According to karma kandiya, the process of fruitive activities, a person performs various sacrifices directed by the Vedas, and in all those sacrifices, animal killing or experimenting on the life of animals to test the power of Vedic mantras is enjoined. Animal killing is certainly conducted under the influence of the mode of ignorance. Even though one may be religiously inclined, animal sacrifice is recommended in the Shastras, not only in the Vedas, but even in the modern scriptures of other sects. These animal sacrifices are recommended in the name of religion, but actually animal sacrifice is meant for persons in the mode of ignorance. When such people kill animals, they can at least do so in the name of religion. However, when the religious system is transcendental, like the Vaishnava religion, there is no place for animal sacrifice. Such a transcendental religious system is recommended by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, 1866. Sarva dharmam parityaja mamikam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papibhyo moksha yishami ma suchaha. Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. Because King Prachini Parishat was engaged in performing various sacrifices in which animals were killed, Narada Muni pointed out that such sacrifices are influenced by the mode of ignorance. From the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam 1.1.2, it is said, Projita Kaitavotra, all kinds of religious systems that are involved in cheating, that's a contradiction, right? All kinds of religious systems that are involved with cheating. What's a religious system that's involved with cheating? It doesn't sound like religion. It sounds like something other. All kinds of religious systems that are involved in cheating are completely kicked out of Srimad Bhagavatam. In the Bhagavad Dharma, the religion dealing with one's relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, animal sacrifice is not recommended in the performance of Sankirtan Yajna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. There is no recommendation for animal sacrifices. So we're about one third of the way through the purport. Maybe one half. In these three verses, King Paranjana, going to the forest to kill animals, is symbolic of the living entities being driven by the mode of ignorance and thus engaging in different activities for sense gratification. The material body itself indicates that the living entity is already influenced by the three modes of material nature and that he is driven to enjoy material resources. When the body is influenced by the mode of ignorance, its infection becomes very acute. When influenced by the mode of passion, the infection is at the symptomatic stage. However, when the body is influenced by the mode of goodness, the materialistic infection becomes purified. The ritualistic ceremonies recommended in religious systems are certainly on the platform of goodness, but because within this material world even the mode of goodness is sometimes polluted by the other qualities, passion and ignorance, a man in goodness is sometimes driven by the influence of ignorance. Paragraph. It is herein described that King Paranjana once went to the forest to kill animals. This means that he, the living entity, came under the influence of the mode of ignorance. The forest in which King Paranjana engaged in hunting was named Pancha Prastha. The word Pancha means five. And this indicates the objects of the five senses. The body has five working senses, namely hands, legs, tongue, rectum, and genitals. By taking full advantage of these working senses, the body enjoys material life. The chariot is driven by five horses, which represent the five sense organs, namely ears, eyes, nose, skin, and tongue. These sensory organs are very easily attracted by the sense objects. Consequently, the horses are described as moving swiftly. On the chariot, King Paranjan kept two explosive weapons, which may be compared to ahankar, or false ego. This false ego is typified by two attitudes. One, I am this body, ahanta, and everything in my bodily relationships belongs to me, mamata. Two explosive weapons in the chariot along with the passenger. There's so much in this purport, but we have a whole other page. The two wheels of the chariot may be compared to the two moving facilities, namely sinful life and religious life. The chariot is decorated with three flags, which represent the three modes of material nature, the five kinds of obstacles. What are they? Or uneven roads represent the five kinds of air passing within the body, prana, apana, udana, samana, and vyana. The body is covered by seven coverings, namely skin, muscle, fat, blood, marrow, bone, and semen. The living entity is covered by three subtle material elements and five gross material elements. These are actually obstacles placed before the living entity on the path of liberation from material bondage. You're doing very well. It's a long purport. You're still awake. There's two more paragraphs. The word rashmi, or rope, in this verse indicates the mind, the steering mechanism, the reins, rope, rashmi. The word nida is also significant, for nida indicates the nest where a bird takes rest. So in this case, nida is the heart where the living entity is situated. The living entity sits in one place only. The causes of his bondage are two. Anybody want to guess that doesn't have a book? Raga Dvesha. Namely, lamentation and illusion. Close. In material existence, the living entity, this is the raga part, simply hankers to get something he can never get. Therefore, he is in illusion. So that's the raga part. As a result of being situated in this illusory situation, the living entity is always lamenting, hankering, lamenting, raga, dvesha. Thus, lamentation and delusion are described herein as dvikubara, the two posts of bondage. So what you put the rein around, like, you know, the steering mechanism, it's tethered to these two posts. Hankering is what the mind does. Hankering, lamenting. Raga, dvesha. Last paragraph. The living entity carries out various desires through five different processes, which indicate the working of the five working senses. The golden ornaments and dress. What's that? You know the story from the Bhagavatam where Narada was testing the Haryashvas, and he told them an allegory. He was testing to see whether they were qualified for his bhakti program, whether they were qualified to be brahmacharis, or were they more suited for grihastha life. And because their intelligence was so sharp, they could understand even this abstract allegory that Narada was presenting. In this case, his audience is not the Haryashvas. It's an attached king. So he has to explain it. But the Haryashvas, they explain very clearly what the allegory was. So the golden ornaments and dress, which everything was covered by, is the mode of passion. One who has a good deal of money and riches is especially driven by the mode of passion. Being influenced by the mode of passion, one desires so many things for enjoyment in this material world. The 11 commanders, we all know what those are. Yeah. Working senses, knowledge acquiring senses, and our dear friend, the mind. The mind is always making plans with the 10 commanders to enjoy the material world. The forest named Pancha Prashta, where the king went to hunt, is the forest of the 5 sense objects. Form, taste, sound, smell, and touch. Last sentence. It's a summary sentence, very much like the introductory sentence. Thus, in these 3 verses, Narada Muni describes the position of the material body and the encagement of the living entity within it. So we're halfway finished with the time for morning class. So I'll just speak some summary points here. There are a few places in the Bhagavatam where allegory is used for instruction. Otherwise, we don't take the Bhagavatam as allegorical. The the narration of events in the Bhagavatam are historical, they're factual. But deliberately in this case, Narada is using the instructive method of allegory because he really wants to help King Prachinipari to come out of his mode of ignorance, influence. It's described in the commentary by our acharyas. Practically speaking, Narada has become the deliverer, the spiritual master, and the deliverer of the whole line from Swayambhuva Manu down, because the lineage of kings is part of one of the subjects of the Bhagavatam, and each of those kings, Uttanapada and Dhruva and so on and so on, the whole line of kings. But here's this one king in that line that somehow escaped. Or because of his heritage, he was a great personality, very religious personality. But he slipped or had lost the essence of the purpose behind the Vedas. And so, losing that essence of the purpose, he fell into ignorance. And although he was doing religious activity, he was driven by the senses and wishing to be the enjoyer immediately of those activities that are religious and enjoyer of the fruits of those activities and being very happy to consider himself religious in the whole process. So repeatedly Prabhupada is addressing in the purport, like four or five times, the point of the influence of the modes of nature that are driving the living entity. And when we're in the midst of being driven by the modes of nature, we don't feel that we're being driven by the modes of nature. We think, that's me. This is my experience. And we're being taken for a ride by the chariot. This body driven by or with the directional flag of the modes of nature. One who is situated in knowledge, or as Prabhupada has described, one who is trained to see, one who has the eyes to see, that sees through the eyes of scripture, Shastra Chakshusha, one can then see what's happening. What's happening is the living entity is being carried by the modes of nature. Just yesterday, there's some having some conversation with some guests that come regularly to the Juhu Temple. And one of the classic questions, you know, how do I make this balance between my spiritual practice and my life in the workplace? Because the life in the workplace, people do and say and eat and, you know, involved with so many things that don't elevate consciousness. How do I keep myself, you know, involved in my occupation but not contaminated by the bad association? How to stay apapavidham, protected and pure, sterilized or free from the infection of the material atmosphere that we find ourselves. So our basic process is the process of hearing and chanting. By that hearing and chanting, we're cleansing, chitta darpana marjanam, we're cleansing our consciousness and uplifting or elevating, spiritually surcharging the original consciousness of the soul once again, so that we can be protected. And so many things can be said. But staying in a mood of giving Krishna consciousness or giving devotion or somehow contemplating, my dear Lord Krishna, give me some, if you so desire, please give some opportunity that this person or this atmosphere can be spiritually benefited. And even thinking in that way, somehow Krishna gives some facility for doing that. But another component that's being presented specifically in the purport here is by being situated in knowledge, one can see with detachment. In other words, various circumstances of life can be learning opportunities or opportunities to see through the scripture. Krishna is giving us the whole panorama of the modes of nature. And one who's trained, as Bhagavatam is training us in a graduate study of what the Bhagavad Gita is also teaching us in the undergraduate study, of seeing things according to the forces or impelling influences of the modes of nature. One who is so trained can see where a living entity is coming from and where they're going to, the modes of nature that are carrying them presently, and where that carrying them is going to take them, driven by desire for sense gratification. So this fundamental thing of driven by the desire for sense gratification, in one sense, sounds like passion. But you don't get that spirit without the nice assist from the mode of ignorance. And the mode of ignorance says, you're something that you're not. You're this body. And since you're this body and your nature is you want to enjoy, then enjoy sense gratification. Put these nice two modes of nature together, the mode of passion and mode of ignorance. And then off you go in your chariot into the place where there's five sense objects, the forest. Panchaprashta. And become an enjoyer. And you have, because you're king, you're the Purusha, you're the enjoyer, you have all these resources that's being supplied because you're the king. And chief amongst them are these two, hankering and lamentation. Because in the allegory, King Paranjan, he could have understood the whole situation right away because he was in a very nice situation, but he was not feeling satisfied because he wanted a queen. He was needing material intelligence to help him get the facility of material enjoyment. So he was searching and searching, despondent, until finally he found her, the queen. And the previous chapter, or as this chapter goes on, the queen gets really upset because the king has gone off to the forest to hunt, and she's left in the palace alone, and her desires aren't being met, and so she's very unhappy. That's the title of the chapter. King Paranjan goes to the forest to hunt, and his queen becomes angry. So right from the get-go, it's a losing program. The nature of material enjoyment is before you even get started. One who fails to have faith in Krishna, even before they begin any undertaking, they're already defeated. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. And that's the way it is also. Before we even begin some undertaking, what to speak of if it's driven by this mode of ignorance? And a symptom of this mode of ignorance, again as a refrain, is animal killing. There's so much in this purport, so I'll just try to keep it very short for time purposes. Again, Narada Muni, in his assessment of Nalukuvera and Manigriva, this is month of Damodar, so that Leela is very intrinsic for this month, how the two Arjuna trees became Arjuna trees because before they were Nalukuvera and Manigriva, and they were in this
situation where, just as described here, because of their great opulence, they were very proud. And this is a very dangerous situation. Better to not have great opulence if one's heart is not pure. It's a very simple math formula. Having material resources plus a heart that's not pure equals pride. And when there's pride in the heart, then one falls. Invariably, one falls. It's not like sometimes. So the business is to make the heart pure. And until the heart is pure, this nivritti is essential. But if one is on the pravritti path, as King Prajinivari is on the pravritti path, it's then one will become very proud, just as Nalakuvera and Manigriva. They became so proud. Intoxicated. Not just intoxicated with the Varuni beverage. They were intoxicated with pride. Specifically, it's described, one of their pride qualities was they're the sons of Kuvera. Their dad is rich. Mega rich. He's the treasure of heaven. How do treasures become wealthy? That's another story. But he's a treasure of heaven. He has so much wealth. So they have so much wealth. And not only that, their dad, Kuvera, is a great devotee of Lord Shiva. So great that Lord Shiva comes and spends time. He makes his residence in this garden that's part of Kuvera's kingdom. He just gifted him. Here, you stay in this nice garden. Mount Kailash is part of the precincts, the garden of the king of the treasure of heaven. So Lord Shiva was very dear to the father. And the father was very dear to Lord Shiva. So I have these reasons for pride, and they were intoxicated with pride. So when they stood naked before Narada, he began to consider not how insulting these people are. Narada didn't have pride. He had compassion. And he began to think, very confidential, how does a pure devotee think when they're insulted? Here's Narada describing how his thought processes when he was in this very abominable situation in heaven. So his consideration was, it goes to the animal killing topic. His consideration was, when someone becomes very proud, then they're capable of doing any hurtful thing to others and it doesn't faze them at all because of their pride, because everything's about me and other people, at my expense, that's not a problem because what's important is me. And specifically, it's described by Narada, and Prabhupada expands this in his purports, that up to inflicting pain and suffering on other living beings such as animals, cruelty to animals is part of what comes from pride. Because if you don't have pride, then how can you do that horrible thing? Just so dull. It's a mode of ignorance act. Then Prabhupada explains in the purport, yet within religions of the world, not only within the Vedas, contemporary sects, he says, modern religious sects, they also have some practice of animal killing. You do it this way, or you do it that way, or you do it the other way. Give it a nice name, perfume it, as Bhadri says, but it's killing. Ignorance in the name of religion. So what Narada wants to do, as with Nalakuvera and Manigriva, but they were so far gone, he decided, you need to be restricted of all your opulence for a long time, because that's the source of your pride. no opulence. Then you'll feel some pain. Then he reasons that as one who is pricked by a thorn knows the pain of being pricked by a thorn, when he sees another person is being pricked by a thorn, he feels their pain. There's empathy. But if you haven't felt pricked by a thorn, it doesn't resonate the same. So better they have no opulence. In King Prachinibari's case, he was more elevated. He didn't need to become a tree for so many thousands of years. He needed to understand the consequence of religion executed in the quality of ignorance. And this killing of animals is a quality of ignorance. A real quick little anecdotal sharing. Part of my service last year took me to China, and the devotees there wanted me to go see some sights. I said, no, thank you. I don't want to do any sightseeing. Oh, come on, come do some sightseeing. No. Come on, do some sightseeing. No. And they were very persistent. Okay, we'll go do some sightseeing. Where are we going to go? So they keep it short because of time. They took me to a place, bigger than Central Park in New York City. Thousands of times more people in that place than Central Park, and Central Park has a lot of people in it, was a place called Temple of Heaven. Anybody here been to Temple of Heaven in Beijing? It's a tourist place for Chinese people. You have to pay to get in. It's like, how to describe, it's like rush hour in New York City going into the subways. This was on a Tuesday afternoon around 2 o'clock. It wasn't rush hour in New York City in the subways. It was people going to this Temple of Heaven. It's like gazillions of people. Just because there's so many people in China. But anyway, so you go inside and there's three parts to it. And the first part is the Temple of Heaven. It's Vedic culture during the Ming Dynasty of China, going back so many thousands of years. So you go up this kind of inside and around and up this kind of little hill and hillock. It's very small. It's a long series of steps. And then this big wall going around, and there's three large buildings, and the main of the three buildings is an altar to the King of Heaven. And then there's devatas that are on either right side, left side, and kind of like an altar, like, you know, not just a shrine, but like an altar, where they would make offerings to the various devatas. And then the big one in the middle, in the back, was Indra. Only they didn't say Indra, they just said King of Heaven. But the sun god, the moon god, and this god, and that god, and the other god, they have names. And they made offerings. And I thought, wow, Vedic culture in China. It just had different names for it. Then over in the other building was, you know, the history of how that building got built, and this dynasty member, that dynasty, this king, that king, and that history. And then there's the Upadevata building. Then you go to the next one, and it's Chinese cosmology that looks like Vedic cosmology. And then the next hillock is where they made these horrific animal sacrifices. Well, there was two things. It's where the emperor would do. There was a fasting house for a day and a half or something. He would go in seclusion and fast to be fit to take part in the sacrifice, and then he would take part in the sacrifice. And then you come up into this area where it has geometrically, mathematically calculated numbers of stones and concentric circles, and he would make proclamations to the King of Heaven about his kingdom, and the citizens would be, you know, I don't know if they had amplification systems then, but people would hear. And then down below was these big urns, like huge things where they, you know, they put the bodies of the slaughtered animals, and they put the jewels, and they put the, you know, very rich cloth and whatever the sacrifices were to the denizens of heaven. Like a big deal, a big part of it was the animal sacrifice part. That's the connection with this. So Vedic culture was all over the world. At least that part of the world, for sure. It's like, today I asked some of the devotees, do the people in China think of this as, wow, this is part of our culture? Or do they think, oh, this is like a museum? And they think it's a museum. Kind of quaint and antiquated and, you know, very distant from their reality. Anyway, animal sacrifice is, there was a Chinese speaking guide who was taking some VIPs from Europe, you know, dressed in suits, Western people. And he made some remark, said, you know, fortunately these people were sacrificed animals, but they didn't have the idea of human sacrifice. And they had a good laugh over that one. But the indication is the animal sacrifice is also ignorant. But there it is within, not Prabhupada elaborately described, it's not that they killed the animal for eating, but even just to involve the animal in that way, or some idea of sacrifice of animal. The nature of it is has nothing to do with our process of hearing and chanting. It's quite distinct. But those that have that interest, it's there for those that have a lower mode of nature in the name of religion. The purpose of this whole allegory, one more time, is to explain to the king, King Prachinibari, that your involvement in religious activity that is of the nature of ignorance, however it may be religious, is not going to carry you to the position, the ultimate destination of the soul. It's going to implicate you in the three modes of nature more deeply and bring unlimited suffering, even though your expectation is the opposite. It will continue to involve you and implicate you in material existence, as long as the intention is sense gratification. So raga dvesha, hankering, the two pillars, the two posts that are operating the mind, or with which the mind operates, carries the senses forward into the forest of the sense objects with the intention of enjoying, and so many other faculties and facilities for that. We're at 5 minutes before the end of class, so the allegory will continue, and the explanation that Narada gives at the end, when he starts explaining, unpacking the allegory for the benefit of the king, is also very, very interesting. Any comments or questions? Yes, sir.
Wearing silk cloth by devotee, is it permissible because it involves killing of many worms? Silk, S-I-L-K, silk.
Silk. Couple of things. This is a nice, delicate question. There are two types of silk. And there's one silk where the silkworms are not killed, and there's some silk where the silkworms are killed. I don't know the detail of it. Do you? There's some detail. I don't know that detail.
Yeah, silk, mostly the worms are killed, and
there's some types of silk where the worms are not killed, and some types where they are. Right? Are you with me with that?
I don't know. I have only idea that the worms are killed. And
there's two types.
I see.
So we offer garments to the deities that are made of silk. Not always, but sometimes. So how can such a thing be justified?
For God it may be all right, but for devotee, whether they should wear.
Okay.
Many devotees are wearing, householder particularly, householder devotees.
Devotee is a devotee. Okay. To be very honest with you, I don't have a fully satisfying to me answer, except this explanation that there are two types of silk, and that the very, very fine, refined silk is silk where the worms are killed, and there's another kind of silk, I forget the name for it, where they're not. Can somebody else in the audience here help me with this particular detail?
Normally the way silk is manufactured is you have the silkworms, they tie themselves in a cocoon of the yarn, which is a secretion from their saliva, from their body. And then this becomes a very hard cocoon. And normally in the outside world, people find it easier to just put that cocoon in boiling water. So the worm is killed, and then you can take out the yarn unbroken. So that is a normal silk where you have killing of the worms. There's another type of silk which is called ahimsa silk, non-violent silk, where you basically cut open the cocoon and release the silkworm and then use the yarn. But the problem there is that the threads or the yarn is broken. So the quality of the cloth is not so good from a material point of view, but it's karma free. So these are the two types of cloths, the silk cloths.
So safer is cotton, in case somebody doesn't know. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.